Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers, using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. I have the lovely Charlie with me today. Hey, Charlie.
Hello, Alex. How are we doing?
Not bad. We've taken you a little bit out of your comfort zone today, but nonetheless, you were like totally up for it. Tell us why.
I was very up for this one because we are talking about a beautiful book which is set in Scotland, which I adore. It's a country I love going to. And so I'm very excited to talk to our guest. We've got Andrew Gregg with us today, and he's written over 20 books of fiction, non-fiction, and poetry. He's been shortlisted for the Walter Scott Prize and has been awarded both the Saltire and Scottish Book Awards. He's hailed as Scotland's Renaissance writer, and he's here with us today to discuss his latest work of historical fiction, Rose Nicholson. Hello, Andrew. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. I've got my coffee. I've got you on the screen and I'm ready to rock and roll.
Fantastic. Well, we should perhaps begin with a setting of the scene. Rose Nicholson opens in Edinburgh in the winter of 1574. What was the political landscape like in Scotland at this point?
Well, it's a shambles. think Afghanistan, think any post-revolutionary situation that has not yet moved on to the next thing. So they've had this reformation to install the Church of Scotland and uninstall the Catholic Church. And it's left every church and monastery and cathedral and most public buildings in Scotland defenestrated, literally. There was not a single piece of unbroken coloured glass, stained glass, from the pre-reformation left in Scotland.
That's awful.
To this day, I mean, they went through every church, every cathedral, every monastery and the Blackfriars, the Greyfriars. I had not realised the extent of damage done by basically crowds whipped up by sermons.
Gosh.
And not just glass, but they broke, confiscated all the rood screens, which are symbolic, and all the carved decorations, carpets, for anything at all fancy, anything that wasn't plain gold was destroyed. And the result is the place is in a mess. All the universities are extremely drafty because the windows are full of holes. I got around to putting the plain glass, which I had to replace it. And to me, that image of beautiful stained glass replaced by, or not replaced by, pale, clean, unfiltered glass was a kind of image for the situation. Everyone was feeling the draft. And Edinburgh and St Andrews in particular were broke. Because a lot of the money and the institutions of the country were bound up in the church, which had just been delegitimized.
Gosh.
So the result was, they said there was no money because all the money in St. Andrews had come from pilgrims to the cathedral. And the cathedral had been wasted and the bones, the relics disappeared, and there was no pilgrims. Pilgrims was a great source of income in that period. And so the entire town was broke, and therefore the university was broke. Very few students, and most of them were extremely pissed off. They felt they were getting a very poor education for far too high fees. And I read this in a book, I mean, in James Melville's diaries from this period, from the 1570s, complaining exactly this. And you could list it and think, oh, yes, dour landladies, chilly days, terrible food.
A bit like all these poor students now, their fees haven't got down yet with COVID.
Well, that's right. And that's what these guys in Andrew felt, because half the stuff was cancelled. Most of the tutors had been delegitimized and weren't allowed to teach, or were drunk, or were Catholic, or worse. And nobody had any money. And the numbers were down to dozens, as I understand it. The university was on the point of collapse. And that was quite an interesting place to turn up in, like Fowler and his young friends in 1574.
One thing that's really strong, I think, in your book is characterization. Before we start to talk about your characters, your description of Jamie Saxe, or James the Sixth of Scotland, later James the First of England, gives us the reader lots of clues as to what kind of king he will grow into. Can you tell us how you've drawn his perceived flaws for the reader?
His perceived flaws. Well, people did tend to emphasize that when he was a child, when he was first presented, age 13 or 14, he shambled, he had problems with his gait, he drooled a bit, he stammered. He was not prepossessing physically at all. He had red hair like all the Stuarts, but he just didn't look good. And he had a tendency to grope. He groped himself and he groped people, particularly men. He was probably as close to bisexual, acknowledged bisexual monarch as we've had. He was not impressive, but he was extremely bright, very lonely. He had no siblings after all, no living grandparents or parents. His mother was down in England, wasn't coming back. His father was literally and definitely wasn't coming back. I mean, he was a very lonely boy, but bright. And he had a very fine education, Protestant education, from a guy called George Buchanan, who was the foremost Latin scholar and writer in Latin in Europe. He was a big deal. So you got a very clever, very bright, very lonely, socially absolutely hopeless young man who's passionate about poetry. So I get kind of warm to him. The worst version of myself in my adolescence.
Gosh. But he reaches out to favourites, doesn't he? That's the interesting thing about Jamie.
Yeah, it gets him into bad political trouble because the favourites all have, you know, ambitions and powers, particularly the glorious, glamorous Esme Stuart, who's part French and was age 34 when James was about 15 and had married with five children. But he was definitely bisexual and wore clothes that no one had ever seen the like of in Presbyterian in Scotland. He was elegant, he was clever, he was witty, and thoroughly seductive. I quite fell for Esme Stuart, just the name.
Actually, I can tell from how you write Esme that you're like him. He really does rock up like a rock star.
Yeah, that's exactly. He rides in the prow of a boat, dressed to the nines, and it's just so elegant and so warm with people. The captain of the boat blushes like a girl when Esme thanks him for his glorious passage, and the captain wishes him a successful time in Scotland, and he said, "I expect that I will do well." And he walks off. He refuses a lift on a horse, and he just decides to walk up the Leith Walk to Edinburgh. He's got no money at all. He's arrived not on a whim, but on a hope and a prayer. And he's going to meet that afternoon, James the Sixth. And they're going to be inseparable for the next 3 years.
Gosh.
Until they're forced to separate.
Yes. Well, this is the fun of favourites, isn't it? They sort of depose each other and get above their station.
And then they invite jealousy. There was an awful lot of infighting and jealousy in James's court. See, the problem with Scotland at this point, you say 1574, it has a series of regents who rule in the name of the king, who's a child and kept in Stirling Castle, either under protection or as a prisoner, whichever way you look at it. And we had four regents in 15 years. First one was shot in the Nithgow through a line of washing. The second one was shot at a close range in a scuffle in Stirling. The third one died horribly after going to a banquet of the fourth one, and Morton, who ruled longest, he was about 7 or 8 years. So we're talking about political, massive instability with a boy who's going to be king, if he's allowed to be, but his mother is still alive and hoping to come back with a French or Spanish army to take back the country. And a lot of people in Scotland would like to see that happen. So what I had in the back of my mind was Brexit with knives.
That is the tagline for the front cover, isn't it?
I think
it's got stuck in my head, but that's the situation. We think we've got problems. Gosh. This is a country divided right down the middle.
I mean, Scottish history is just, you know, this time is just a series of brutal murders of people in power, one after the other. Jamie's own father, Lord Darnley, is one of my favourites. You know, his castle's found exploded and he's found outside strangled. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that was pretty melodramatic. Yes, he was found unconscious and was probably then strangled, but hard to be sure. It depends who you listen to.
And someone went to finish off the job. My goodness.
A number of people are getting bumped off, particularly the high hegians. If you were important, you got executed. If you're a lower minion, you got hanged. And being hanged was regarded as an insult if you were classy.
Yeah, at least do me the honour of cutting my head off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Any fans of the fiction like Game of Thrones, you know, just read Scottish history. It's better. It's more bloody.
The Red Wedding in Game of Thrones, season 3, is Scottish history, isn't it?
No. Oh, gosh. Right. Yes. And I can buy that. These characters are so big and so vital. They seem to live incredibly vitally, at least in our imagination, because a lot of them are short-lived. And it just kind of makes them all the more intriguing. And there's lots of love and sex. And I mean, James VI's father had how many illegitimate children? He died at 25. And he left somehow 7, 8, 9, it's hard to say. A shortage of legitimate children, that was part of the problem.
Gosh, I mean, yeah, that's a big issue for the Stuart monarchy going forward, for many generations.
There's a lot of Stuarts, and they're all closely related, and a lot of them want the throne.
Mm.
And most of the people who want the throne are James VI's cousins and half cousins and quarter cousins and uncles in one case, and grandfather in another. And his mother, of course, wants the throne back.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, no wonder the guy's kind of struggling. I really felt for him. I came to think actually he was, as they say, the wisest fool in Christendom. He was smart, he was subtle, and he above all survived. Reigned 57 years, something like that.
I mean, that's impressive in itself, just to have got to the age where you can die in your own bed, regardless of who helps you die there.
Well, yeah, he died of natural causes, I believe.
There was a lot of people who suggested that perhaps Buckingham was involved, but I think that's mainly because they hated Buckingham. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent because I love these people. But your story, Rose Nicholson, isn't directly about any of these big figures. Tell us about your protagonist, William Fowler. Who's he?
Okay, well, I tend to relate naturally to people that, you know, more of my kind of status. William Fowler is a real person. And he's born 1560, which is the year of the Scottish Reformation, which is very handy. He's a son of a trader, a burgess of Edinburgh, furniture maker, and his mother's very interesting. His mother's called Janet Fockart, mm-hmm. and she's a well-known wadwife, which is a wonderful word for a moneylender. What's now, she carries a wad. Well, that's probably kind of personal, actually, and she lent money against security. She was a formidable businesswoman and a formidable character. I was a bit frightened of it, and he was a bit frightened of it. She remains Catholic and gets off with it because she's lending money to the church and the court and the nobility and the town council and everybody. So she's allowed, as some people did, can't carry on being Catholic. His father gets shot during the Lang Siege, which is an endless castle's under siege for about 3 years. So he's already an orphan. He's about 12, William Fowler. And he becomes a student at St Andrews. This is, I know this, 74 to 78. And does quite well and forms some friendships that are going to last the rest of his life. One with a guy called Tom Nicholson, who's a poor scholar. It doesn't mean he's a lousy student. It means he's got no money. And he comes from a fishing family, and the fishermen were always poor at St Andrews. The harbour was useless piece. Handily, he has a sister. I'll get to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. And the other one is young Walter Scott, or Branksome and Buccleuch, as he grandly calls himself, aged 15. And Scott and Buccleuch is a weaver, not an outlaw, but a rustler by trade. And to survive, he has to kill people, because he's supposed to kill about 20 people by the age of 20 individually. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt that a number of attempts to kill him were launched. So that's William Fowler. He hopes of becoming a poet. He's a natural businessman through his mother. Doesn't want to be a businessman, but that's actually what he's good at. Mm. He's basically a pen for hire with ambitions beyond his station, and he falls inevitably in love with Rose Nicholson, his friend Tom Nicholson's sister. She's about the only girl he can ever possibly meet in St. Andrews. Because there's no female students, of course. And they're not by and large in the shops. In some ways, it's you've got to imagine it's like being life under the Taliban. Mm-hmm. The places where women can appear are very, very restricted. And as for a chance to actually get off with one, you can't go to a dance meet a girl because Andrew's not allowed under the new dispensation of the Presbyterian Kirk. You can't, dancing is not allowed, music's not approved, or there's no plays. There's no movie. So it was very helpful.
It's like COVID, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very helpful with this lad. His friend had a sister, Rose. And I gradually realised that she's educated because the Church of Scotland, God bless them, this is one of the great things about them. They're a pretty dour and joyless bunch of them, but they'd be totally in literacy. All parishes have to have a school for boys and girls, because girls also had souls, apparently. And that's why girls have to be able to read as well, not to read the Gospels. And they have to be able to read the Gospels so as to make up their own minds about the truths in them. Because you couldn't take Gospel truth from the priests, because there were no priests, or the Pope, or the King. That's really important. The King was not head of the Church of Scotland. The King was just a man. He might be king in the secular world, but in the religious world, he was just all equal in the sight of God. So Rose Nicholson can read in Latin, because most of his education was in reading and writing Latin. And this is basic and important stuff, because it means that she could read what the humanists of the time were reading, which was Latin and Greek texts. Greek texts usually translated into Latin by this time. And I gradually realized that she was not only as bright as her brother, she was actually even brighter. And her brother was very, very bright. And that her capacity for original thought was going to become sooner or later a danger. And I thought, now I've got a plot. But a love story, and three young men with ambitions, and a woman who's inevitably going to become imperiled.
When you started writing the plot, much of the dialogue, you've done it in Scots with a handy dictionary of terms in the back for those who aren't fluent. How important was it for you to write in the native tongue?
It seemed absurd to write it entirely in standard English, I guess. But I didn't want it to be, too colloquial. So there's no Americanisms, for instance, that would be ridiculous. So what I wanted to write it in was, and if I wrote it in pure Scots, I couldn't read it. You couldn't. It wouldn't be spelled the same. I mean, it would be incomprehensible to anyone other than a serious historian scholar. So like my last book, Fair Helen, which was set in the same period, this was about the border reavers, I evolved a way of writing quite a plain English. Imagine like porridge with little flakes of salt scattered on it, and little bits of honey, and that's the sprinkling of Scots and occasionally French and Latin words, because these people, again, would have naturally used French and Latin a lot. They didn't want to have too much of that, because that would make it hard. So I drew on the Scots of my father, who's from the northeast of Scotland, and that's called Doric Scots, and Lallans or Lowland Scots, which is what I had been surrounded by most of my life. I love the words. I love the word dreich. You need a word like dreich if you live in Scotland, which is a state of mind as well as a state of weather. Words like stramash, words like glaikit, that's for foolish. And I try to make them all pretty clear by context what they must mean. But if you're unsure, you know, there is the glossary at the end. It's a translation. The whole thing's a translation of how somebody might have written and thought, because it's a memoir, thought and felt in the 16th century.
Yes, it's, I mean, as an English person reading from south of the border, it's so wonderful because when you are reading the Scots, you're hearing the accents, you can hear them as you're reading. And this may or may not make you laugh, but when I was reading Rose Nicholson, she was Claire Grogan. I don't know why I had her exact intonations and her voice in my head.
Well, she can voice it anytime she wants. Yeah.
Wouldn't she be wonderful? Oh, mm-hmm. My goodness. My husband's had a crush on her since the 80s.
I see that. I probably will have to acknowledge that.
we love her in this house. But yes, the dictionary came in very, very handy. And I learned a lot of new words. I want to jump back a little bit from Rose herself and talk about Will again. Did having a character like Will, who's outside of the big characters, did that help you to get into the complex political stuff more than perhaps writing a book about Jamie Sachs would have?
Okay, well, yes, I had no desire to write a novel of Jamie Sachs or any of the key players. Mm. My natural point of view is at the fringes, not quite the outside, but at the fringes looping in. There's an early scene where Will is about to leave the family home to go to university. He stands hesitating at the top of the high street, half in and half out of the door. And I think his whole life of the real person was like that. He managed to make an existence at the edge of the court, but he was never of the court. He never became gentry. He became a burgess eventually. Mm-hmm. I relate to people who are at the edge of things, partly because they can watch and they can see. And I'm fascinated by how small Edinburgh and St Andrews were at the time. Edinburgh this time is a population of about 12,000 people.
Gosh.
That's not many. Now, so you would know all of each other by sight. You would see Knox over and over again. You see Lord this, Duke that, Regent this. You would see them. And they'd all be known and gossiped and talked about and observed. So I found it easy to be Will standing beside his father when he's selling a writing case to John Knox. These people see history, historical figures, going by them all the time. And for the most part, it doesn't touch them. But I'm very interested in how, in some of our lives, probably in most, at some point or other, history kind of brushes up really close to us. You know, really close. You know, each arrested or killed or married or something. Things happen very closely, particularly in a country, in a city that's as small as Edinburgh is then. It's almost inevitable that you would be at the edge of things. So Fowler, through a small writing group, which Jamie Sachs is a member of, is at the edge of political assassination and a couple of kidnappings, without pushing the likelihood, without making him a superhero or anything. Because he was a spy. He reported on the Scottish government to the English government and on the English government to the Scottish government. And he was paid to do this. And this was regarded as perfectly normal thing to do. He sold information and he sold his good handwriting. So he wrote documents, official documents. And that's the kind of role of intellectuals of the time. You're asked to write pamphlets for other people and sometimes for themselves. So I kind of related to this person as a kind of writer for hire, kind of in it and wants to do better, but will always slightly disappoint himself. He's finally bought off with a pension of 2,000 acres in a bog in Ireland. It feels as insulting, he never goes there. It's never going to be a story of huge success.
Yeah.
It's a story of a life, a hope that people can relate to, of ambitions and hopes and yearnings, happy accidents and disappointments.
I'll never forget, I remember someone asked James Cameron, they said, why did you invent two fictional characters in Titanic when you then went and like meticulously found lookalikes for all the real people and had all the real amazing stories? And he said, why would I not? If I had two fictional people, I could send them anywhere. They could do anything. They could see anything. gave me total freedom to explore the story without having to stick to an actual narrative of events left by real people. And when you think about it like that, it's like, well, yeah, why would I not?
It's an interesting quandary to be in. I mean, I try to not do any damage to what history I have and know. Somebody, a very few people might notice that John Knox dies a couple of years from when he actually did. That had to be the case for various reasons. Mm. But I like to play the game inside what we know, and there's loads of room to invent. And often things you find out about people give you ideas for them you'd never have had otherwise. You couldn't have invented. I mean, like the mother of Scott of the Clue, Margaret Douglas, she's really, really amazing and scary. She has loads of children by various husbands. And finally, appalling Bothwell, who, when he's not rampaging around the country, still has another 5-6 children with her. Well, she had about 5 or 6 by her first husband, and she lives to 91. And she is just something else. And Janet Fockart, again, is a redoubtable woman with the good sense to remain a widow. It was the only way you could carry on control of your finances and your legal status was having been married, and then your husband dies or is killed, and then you remain a widow. So she gets very close to Esme Stewart, inevitably. But I just found these two women to be such interesting people, and young Fowler's rather in awe of them.
I mean, the female characters in this book are incredibly strong. I'm thinking particularly about the mother of another character who features quite prominently. Let's talk about Walter Scott. He's bound very tightly with Will's story.
Yeah, well I'd fallen for Walter Scott of Branksome and Buccleuch when I was writing Fair Helen, which was the historical novel I wrote before this one, because he was such a splendid villain. He just took over the thing. He was really scary. Partly because he was funny and witty and calculating and imaginative and quite flirtatious, but extremely violent. That kind of calculated violence as opposed to just a loose cannons, like bottles. And that's what was really scary about him, about Scott of Buccleuch. And so when I got a chance to meet his mother, imaginatively, when Laura Fowler goes, for the first time, and she was everything I expected. She was Juno, he describes her as. She was tall, she was about 6 feet. So some women were. Mary Queen of Scots was 5'11". And she was the kind of woman he'd never seen before. He was fascinated and terrified. And she's quite seductive. She's also very physically close with her son, who she guides, whose political life she guides. She's eventually, in fact, banned from being within a mile of Edinburgh, and James, the person of James and his court, is eventually forced pardon. But she was a player, a significant player, not just as his mother, but through marriage, she was related to all kinds of important people, and she had plans. And so it was great to hang out with her, and she also helpfully owns a vineyard in Padua and teaches him how to taste and enjoy Italian wine, teaches Fowler. Because what I had intended to write was a novel called Padua.
Right.
This is what I was commissioned to write. And what I ended up with was Rose Nicholson. Huh. Padua came from discovery that a young Walter Scott, Branksome and Buccleuch, William Fowler, and a person called Thomas Nicholson, Ayn Lackey, brackets PhD, brackets, had matriculated at Padua University. In 1591. And I thought, what are they doing there? And I told this to my editor, because he was fascinated as well. And it was the time of Galileo, was lecturing in algebra at the time, Philip Sidney, important English poet. A lot of really interesting people were in Padua at this time. The young Scotsman. And my editor said, that sounds really good. Here's a check. And I thought, I have to find out how these guys met. And that was in the opening chapter, which grew into an entire volume. And they never get to Padua. That'll be another book. I'd like to write the third book of this trilogy of Fair Helen, Rose Nicholson, and one just called Padua. So we never get to Padua in this, but she is connected to Lady Margaret Douglas, has a vineyard and has a kind of endowed monastery, nunnery, in Padua, which will come in useful.
Yeah, you've got your way out there. That's good.
Yeah. I like ending a book with a kind of resolution, but also with a future that people are going to move on into.
Brilliant. You've already mentioned this in the course of the discussion, and that's the university at St Andrews. Mm. The university is almost a character in itself within your story. How involved were the academics in the political wrangling of the Scottish court and parliament?
Oh, well, very much. Partly because we educated most of them. Universities were fighting, as always, for their independence. And they were fighting from their independence from the Kirk, who wanted to control the universities by appointing only established Protestants. And also with the court. And of course, the king wanted to be in charge of universities. And the town council felt that, well, they own the buildings, and so truly they should have control. So the in the nature of a university is that they're perpetually wrangling with the supremacy and control with all the other civic powers. And in this case, in Scotland, with the religious power. And I found that so interesting that it's inevitable that nearly all the tutors were Catholic or had been Catholic. And because they couldn't suddenly invent new tutors who were Protestants, you couldn't educate them in time. That was just had to be allowed to pass by. And so you had important people like George Buchanan, who had become Protestants, lecturing and teaching. And the idea of a university that's flat broke, desperate, and fighting for its existence, let alone its independence, it just fascinated me. Yeah, I mean, I should say I was born and brought up in Anstruther, near St Andrews. So it was our big town. We went over the hill to go shopping in St Andrews. And my earliest impressions were this huge ruined cathedral. To me, that's, and then there's the ruined and now rebuilt largely Bishop's Palace. And then these ruined bits of ports and monasteries. And even in this was the 1960s, you could see the 16th century, visibly there. The whole setup and layout of St Andrews was exactly the same one that my people are in. And that helped so much. I was going back to St Andrews, walking down those streets, seeing the bits where the martyrs were burned, the scorch marks and the cobbles. Yeah. I mean, it really helped me believe. Because I think writing historical novels is essentially living in a waking dream. I don't feel I invent it. I kind of read and think and then go there and get wet, get rained on, out in the sea, get bitten by midges, and walk on the streets until I believe it, so I can slip back 500 years. And because if I believe it and I feel I've seen these things in my mind's eye and also experienced them on my body, then there's a chance that the reader can believe it as well, be there, which I think is what you want to be as a reader. When I read books, I want to be there. And that's why that's my method, is to research and then go there. Gosh, and hang out in the moonlight and in the rain, sunlight, and think things invent themselves then. Excellent. I hope I've given some of what. Obviously, there's so many things that I could say because I still live in this book. I have some difficulty exiting it. All I can do is spill stuff out and hope it makes sense and that people will read the book. So that's the way to do it.
Well, I hope that people will pick up Rose Nicholson, especially if they love Scotland, because it is like walking these streets. And I can totally feel that you have experienced these places and walked through them. And as someone who writes 17th century London, I'm incredibly jealous that you have so much left that you can actually walk around and experience.
There's some 17th century London, but not a huge amount, I guess, because it's been developed in the way that Edinburgh and St Andrews, to some extent, have not been totally redeveloped. And they never got destroyed in fires or wars.
It's an incredible place. So yes, if you are missing traveling north of the border, people, please pick up a copy of Rose Nicholson by Andrew Gregg, because it is absolutely stunning and a really good fun read. Andrew, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Thank you. Very enjoyable.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.